It's my pleasure to talk to you all this evening. I was hoping that if I wore a tie and a coat, people would confuse me with a well-paid expert from out of town. But unfortunately, I don't think it's worked. But what I would like to do this evening is to go ahead and why don't you bring up the title slide here? We're going to talk about the Battle of New Orleans, and I do have some notes I will be referring to for the really technical parts. But the beautiful thing, or the unusual thing about the Battle of New Orleans, is it's almost unknown. This battle, the loss of New Orleans, happened barely at the end of the first year of the war. This is the most populous city in the South, 170,000 people. It is a center of commerce. Everything produced in the Midwest at one time came down the Mississippi River. By this time, the railroads are beginning to compete, so some of that traffic has been drawn off and is now going east to west on railroads. But it's a very unusual thing to see the city fall so early in the war. So that's what we're really going to talk about here. All right, next slide. Okay, New Orleans, all right, early in the war, it has, when hostilities broke out, there are two U.S. Navy ships, USS Powhatan and USS Brooklyn, quickly establish a blockade at the mouth of the Mississippi River. Now, the Confederates had hoped that it was not going to be blocked, and so they had not taken any precautions at that point. So, initially, these ships went actually up to the head of passes. In September 1861, the Union seized Ship Island, which is south of the Mississippi. This is the same island that the British had used in 1815 to land their troops that went in and captured New Orleans. It had been occupied by Mississippi troops for a while, but as more and more Confederate troops got called north, the island was abandoned by the state of Mississippi, and it was left alone, and in September of 1861, the Union seized it, used it as a major base for their blockading fleet thereafter. It's used because it has a deep water anchorage. The water in this area gets rather shallow, and because it is a deep water anchorage, it appealed in the War of 1812, and it appeals here. Now, attempt to blockade the river using Union ships at the head of the passes actually came to an end because there is a Confederate ram called the Manassas, and it came out in October 1861 and managed to chase all the Yankees away. It is basically a tugboat that has been covered with a concave, a curved sheet of armor. It's about an inch and a half of steel, and it actually is made such that when a shell hits it, it's curved. The shells are supposed to bounce off and go other places. It has only a single gun, and they started with a 64-pounder. That was a little too much. They settled in for a 32-pounder. Next. This is the area that we're looking at. This is the Mississippi River Delta right out of the official records atlas. Okay, here is New Orleans. Lake Pontchartrain is up here. All this is the Delta. This is all swamps. It's a very, very difficult territory. The defenses of New Orleans depend on two forts. These forts down here, Fort St. Philip and Fort Jackson. Fort St. Philip was originally put in there by the Spaniards back in the 1700s. Fort Jackson has been added after the War of 1812. And so these are to control the access up the river. The Delta actually has three entrances down here. We'll see that with the next slide. Here are the three passes, and where they all come together is called Head of the Passes. And that is where the Union set up their initial blockade in September of 1861. Fort St. Philip is on the north side of this This U-bend in the river is called the Plaquemine Bend. Fort Jackson is on the south side. Both of these forts are masonry forts. This one is much earlier. Fort Jackson is relatively new. It's only been around for 30, 40 years. It is a very secure fort in that it has, it's a class 3 fort, the type that Robert E. Lee went all over the country building. All right, next slide. This is the Confederate Ram Manassas, CSS Manassas. Ironclad Ram, 1861 to 1862. It was a tugboat. They put this cover on top of it. It's an inch and a half of steel over about 4 inches of wood. And it was intended to bounce shells off, just encourage them to hit and keep going. And this is a location where the gun, it was a single gun and it fired only forward. It is intentionally and primarily a ram. It wants to go around and poke holes in other ships. It's steam powered as a tugboat. The problem is that it does not have a tremendous amount of power. The most that this ram could go, it could go 4 miles an hour. In a real downhill, they might get it up to 6, but it's not terribly fast, because if you realize that the Mississippi River, sometimes the river runs at 4 or 5 knots. Sometimes you'd have a hard time getting home. All right, next slide. Okay, the Confederate government policy this early in the war favored the defense of the Tennessee River Valley early in the war at some cost to the defense of New Orleans. And this is where we see the choice is made as to what is going to get the priority. The New Orleans defenses are not going to get priority because they appear to be excellent. And why? Because the interior lines, they can throw up fortifications from Lake Pontchartrain to the Chalmette Battery, which is an artillery battery, right at New Orleans, right on the river. And everything outside of that are swamps. And the swamps around the city were considered to be a formidable defense. Generally, they were. But the river itself was the weak point. They prepared exterior defenses near the forts 90 miles below the city on Plaquemine Bend. They relied on those forts. Now, the major weaknesses in this defense, a failure to appreciate the urgency of the situation and the capabilities that the U.S. Navy would have to get up that river. And secondly, the belief that the most serious threat to the city was much more likely to come down from the north. The Eads gunboats that had been built on the Mississippi River out of Cairo, Illinois, are one of the threats that exist on the upper river. And there's a great fear that they are going to come south and approach New Orleans from the south, they're going to come south and approach New Orleans from the north. Well, that's a great idea. The only problem is that if you're forts are going to protect you. That's the only thing you've got left, the forts and the swamps. All right, next. All right, the river defenses. The defenses that are going to exist here at New Orleans, the ironclad Ram Manassas. It was ready in September 1861. It chased the early Union boats out of the Hedda Passes and made them blockade from outside the three entrances rather than all the way in at the head of passes. But the gunboats, well, they have the ironclad ram and 12 unarmored gunboats. Those are available for the defense of New Orleans. Two armored gunboats are the unarmed gunboats are under three different commanders. Big flag, caution. Six of the gunboats are nominally under command of the Confederate Army, but in actuality, they are manned by an unreliable and undisciplined lot of rivermen who would take orders from no one. Right? Four of the gunboats are under Confederate Navy command, as is the Manassas. Two of the gunboats are Louisiana State Navy, and they take their orders from the governor of Louisiana. Right? there are two ironclads in New Orleans that are actually being built. They're going to be brand new ones. Each one of those is going to mount 16 guns. They're called the Louisiana and the Mississippi. We're going to get into a little confusion here because we're going to find that the Mississippi, there are two Mississippis here. The Union has a ship named the Mississippi. The Confederates have a ship named the Mississippi. The Mississippi that belongs to the Confederates is still building and doesn't actually participate. So when you see somebody shooting at somebody, it's the Union ship because this one with 16 guns hasn't been finished yet. All right, next. The second element of defense that's going to defend New Orleans is the river booms. Below the forts, but within range of their guns, they put a great boom across the river. And it's held in place because there's about a 4-knot current that can run through the Mississippi River. It has a large number of 3,000-pound anchors, and then it's secured on each riverbank. The boom itself is made of sturdy cypress logs, each 40 feet long and 5 feet thick, held in place by large booms and heavy chains. That would work well if everything was working right. However, the period we're talking about, and we're going to see that the interest that the Union Navy has develops late in 1861, and so in early 1862, they're looking at the river having been had a very, very wet spring, and so they have had a lot of debris come down, and it's torn up a lot of those booms. So these 3,000-pound anchors are not able to hold the booms in place, and a lot of them were pulled out. The gap is temporarily fixed. They take and dismast some small schooners. They chain them together, and they stick them in between the places where the booms are missing and try to close the gap. Now, there is a second chain, and that is in New Orleans. If that chain was available and had been used, it would have been adequate and complete to put across the southern entrance. However, it had already been placed across to the north to keep the smaller gunboats that they feared were eventually going to come down the Mississippi River. And those are run by Flag Officer Foote, his little ironclad gunboats up there. So the one existing remaining actual barrier that they have has already been in place on the other side of New Orleans. Next. Okay. The river defenses the forts. This is the outermost and first obstacle that anyone coming up the river has to have. Fort Jackson, a star-shaped brick fort, mounted 90-some guns, of which only 16 are casemated. And a casemate means it's actually inside of a room that is in the stone part of the fort. And it's made so that it can train. You don't get an awful lot of elevation with the guns in this period, but you certainly can get them trained one direction or another. But a contemporary quote by a Southerner shows the popular view of the defense of New Orleans. Nothing afloat could pass the forts. Nothing that walked could get through our swamps. And so everything, that's kind of the end of the story. This gentleman here, Major General Mansfield Lowell, Confederate States, is chosen to command the New Orleans defenses. General Mansfield has a rather strange history. Let me tell you briefly. He's actually a mariner, a Marylander. He graduated from the Military Academy in 1842. He was the son of the Surgeon General, U.S. Army Surgeon General, and served on the frontier and in the Mexican War. Got a couple of awards, brevets for bravery and service. He resigned in 1849, became an iron manufacturer, and actually was the deputy street commissioner for the city of New York. A very responsible position for a very large metropolitan city. So that's where he is when the war, as the war approaches. He happens to know Joe Johnson. Joe Johnson apparently has seen Lavelle before and likes him. So when the war is breaking out, he goes to President Davis and says, I recommend that you get a hold of this guy Lavelle. So Lavelle is offered a commission as a general in the Confederate Army. And so he leaves his job as the street commissioner in New York City and goes down and gets the job of being commander of the New Orleans defenses. So he is the gentleman in charge at the location today, at this time. Go ahead. This is the situation at Plaquemine Bend, where the all the river traffic that's going to be coming up. This goes out to the sea. This goes up to the city. These are the two forts. Fort Jackson, the newer, larger, is right here at the bend. This is the older fort, Fort St. Philip. It's slightly smaller, it's older, and it's put here. What we'll eventually see, we'll see that there will be a Union mortar fleet that will come up, and they will sit themselves here, and they will be able to sit behind these trees and lob shells into Fort Jackson at a distance of 2 miles. And of course, this area having belonged to the United States before, the Coast and Geodetic Survey has a very accurate description and location of where Fort St. Philip and Fort St. Jackson are. So even though they may not be able to see them directly, they have very excellent maps, and they can shoot blind almost. There will also be some other mortar boats that will go after Fort St. Philip. The Louisiana, the new 16-gun ironclad, is nearing completion in the spring of 1862. It still has problems with its engines. It also has a couple of design problems. Among other things, the actual gun ports that the guns are mounted in are rather restrictive, so it limits its field of fire. It's not fully operational, and so. But when General Lovell and his naval commander feel that they are likely to be attacked on the river, they go ahead and tell them to take the Louisiana out and tie it up alongside here under the protection of Fort St. Philip. There's a little discussion between the commander of the Louisiana and the commander of Fort St. Philip. The commander of Fort St. Philip wants Louisiana to be over here so it can protect the barrier, and it will draw fire away from Fort St. Philip. All right, but the commanding officer of the Louisiana says, "Oh no, I don't have my engines are not fully operational. I want to remain closer to the fort so that the fort's guns can help protect me." And I think the commander of the ship wins out, because he spends most of his time during this period right in here. This is the barrier boom. And remember that in a couple of places, that boom was broken during the winter. It's been temporarily fixed by using these sloops. They sink them into the bottom of the river. They don't completely disappear out of view. And they are connected by heavy chains, so that there is still a barrier there. It's just not the original log barrier. Next. Okay, the Confederate troops that are going to man this defense, General Lovell, commander of the Confederate Department Number 1, is charged with the defense of New Orleans. He receives very little in the way of assistance. When Pensacola was abandoned, its cannons were sent to Mobile in spite of Lovell's request for them. The United States Navy Yard in Pensacola is taken over by the Confederates shortly after the war starts. Those are the guns that are in question. Those guns are not sent to New Orleans. They're sent to Mobile. Even though Lavelle has put in a request for them, they don't make it. As the Union Naval Expedition arrived in March 1862, Confederate guns and troops that have been stationed in New Orleans up to this point have orders to go north to Tennessee, and they start pulling out. By early April 1862, all the regular Confederate troops, all the regulars, have been pulled out of New Orleans and are sent north to fight at Corinth. Lavelle had only garrison troops from the forts. That's less than 1,500 men. Those in the city, 3,000, and they're 90-day militiamen, and several companies of sharpshooters. And of the whole group, a good portion of them, that's 4,500. There's almost, there's 1,800 that are armed only with shotguns. So there is a real shortage here of troops to actually make that work. Next. Now, the Union, in looking at this prize sitting down here in the Mississippi River, gets together with the Union Army and says, well, we think we can go up the Mississippi River and take New Orleans. The U.S. Army looks at him and says, you're crazy. That'll take 50,000 men, and you'll have to use all the ships you got. Well, there are some players in this debate. The Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Gustavus V. Fox, and Commander David D. Porter, both very professional, both felt that the fleet could pass the forts and force the city to surrender. Gustavus V. Fox is a long-term naval officer. He retired. He served until he was a midshipman and then served up until the Mexican War. At the end of the Mexican War, after 18 years, he decided to retire because he had only made the command, he'd only made the rank of lieutenant, the equivalent of a captain in the Army. And he decided that was an awful long time. So he left the Navy. But because of his knowledge and a background, he immediately goes to Washington and gets employed by the Secretary of the Navy. So he is the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Now, David D. Porter knows Gustavus Fox, and now he knows that Gustavus Fox has the ear of the Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles. All right. Now, David Porter is a very professional sailor. He is the son of David Porter, who in the War of 1812 took a single ship, the USS Essex, and cleaned out the Pacific Ocean of all the British whaling fleet in the course of about a year and a half, and really did a very, very fine job. But that was his father. Now, he is a I guess he's about 40, in his mid-40s at this point in his career, but he's very active and very, very aggressive. He gets himself into a lot of trouble occasionally because he knows people like Gustavus Fox. Because of his father, he knows probably most of the naval officers in the Navy, and he has a way of kind of getting what he wants. And if you are this man's superior, you got to watch out, because he can go behind you and talk to somebody else and create some problems. And so that occasionally puts him into a little bit of trouble. But the Army objections are satisfied because Porter says, well, I tell you what, we will give you a mortar flotilla that will actually be able to throw mortar shells into those two forts, and that will augment the size and effectiveness of our fleet. So if the Navy agreed to do that, they also said, and if you decide we can, that's enough, we will, the Army said, we will accept your offer. They would only offer 13,000, depending on the sources. There's another source that I read that said that was, the Army had offered 18,000 troops. But that's a far cry from their original thought that it was going to take 50,000 troops to land there, all right? And it's going to be under some of the one of the most famous generals and most popular generals in Southern history, General Ben Butler. He's going to command these troops. And so, but it's only going to be a relatively small number. Now, Gideon Welles, the Secretary of the Navy, looks around and said, well, if we're really going to try to go up that river, I want to make sure I handpick the officer that's going to be in charge of this expedition, because he has got to have his head on straight. He's got to have the ability to see where he's going and stick to it. And it turns out that he goes to look at who all is available in the ranks of the United States Navy, and he goes down and finds that there is a gentleman that he knows, Captain David Glasgow Farragut. He is 37th or 36th in the line of seniority of captains in the U.S. Navy. But Wells says, that's the guy I want. I know how he operates, and I want him to take charge of that expedition. So he is picked, and he becomes jumped up to over a whole bunch of other, with an advanced date of rank. He jumps over the heads of a number of his contemporaries and becomes the commander of the expedition. And he becomes also collateral duty. As long as you're taking New Orleans, we're going to make you put you in charge of the Western Gulf blockading squadron. So as of January 1862. So this is really when the plan starts to come together. Farragut is now in charge. He's got David Porter working, and Porter is the responsible for this idea that they're going to actually use mortars, these mortar boats, on the forts. Next slide. And this is a picture of old Father Neptune, as he was frequently referred to, Gideon Wells, Secretary of the Navy. And this is his assistant, Gustavus Vasa Fox. And Vasa Fox is very, very close to David Porter. And so they have a real ability to cooperate there. Next slide. This is David Dixon Porter, and this is David Glasgow Farragut. And I mentioned earlier David Porter, who had actually commanded USS Essex in the War of 1812. That was David Dixon's father. David Glasgow Farragut's father, his mother had died at when he was relatively young, and his father was having a hard time getting along as a single parent. And he leaned an awful lot on his friend, David Porter, and eventually David Glasgow Farragut would be turned over and actually be raised by David Porter. And so David Dixon Porter and David Glasgow Farragut have been, for the most of their lives, been raised by the same father. They were both Navy, and so it not a problem. But David Glasgow Farragut is considerably older than David Dixon Porter. This Porter has another brother, William Porter, who's actually running some of those gunboats up the river in Tennessee, and he's not going to be as popular or as well known as his younger brother, but he is also one of the Porter brothers. Farragut is really going to be make his name at this job. All right, next. Well, Porter, now to do his mortar jobs, he assembles 21 schooners from the New York Philadelphia area for the mortar flotilla. The schooners are strengthened amidships, and each is given a 13-inch mortar. A 13-inch mortar shoots a great huge ball of about 300 pounds, and it's got explosives, and you light a fuse, and it goes over and bang, and it's supposed to be cut so that the fuse goes off so that it explodes in the air over the fortification, and it's a shrapnel type of thing. But those mortars are huge. We'll see a picture of one in just a minute. They weigh several tons. So when you get a small sailing ship like a schooner and you put a several ton mortar in the middle of it, you do have to do a little strengthening of it to keep it from breaking in two the first time it's fired. But Porter gets that done, and he gets started. By the end of February, say January is when Farragut's in charge, by the end of February, the mortar flotilla is already down in Key West. They're conducting target practice under Porter's direction, and Farragut is establishing his forward base on Ship Island. All right. The assault fleet that is available to Farragut, four first-class steam sloops, a veteran sidewheeler, and this is the Union Mississippi, and 12 smaller sloops, often called gunboats. A sloop is basically all the ships at this time are rigged for sail, but some of them are actually steam powered, and they use the sails as only auxiliary power. But a sloop basically is not as big as a frigate or a ship of the line, but it has a single row of guns on each side. They're of a size that they can make it up the river. As we'll see, there's going to be a problem with some of the bigger ships. Okay, Farragut tells Fox in March 1862 he's ready to head for the river as soon as Porter joins him, but he's got problems. Okay, next. Here's one of Porter's mortars. All right. This is what he gets. They're uniformly about that same size. They're not great big things. They're what we would call yachts today. But this is a 13-inch mortar, and that weighs probably about 2 tons. And it has to be put on a foundation that goes all the way down to the keel, or the first time you fire it, it'll go right through the deck. So you have to make sure that it's firmly anchored. Next. Well, during this delay, and the delay is primarily due to the mud that has been carried down by the Mississippi River during the winter. They're coming into this now in March, in early April, and they find out that the river is a lot shallower now than it was when they went in and looked at it last fall. So they're going to have to work around that. So while they're doing that, Farragut puts his ears out. He gets a number of agents to tell him what they know and the plan for the forts and their garrison strengths. He gets deserters to give him estimates of who's where. He learned that many New Orleans soldiers are being sent north. They're pulling all the soldiers out of New Orleans. He found out that Nashville has fallen to the Union, so that's fairly early in 1862. Secretary Wells tells him that the Confederate ironclads are in New Orleans, and he recounted the results of the Virginia attacking the Union fleet in Hampton Roads, so that they won't catch Farragut by surprise. He's been fairly warned. All the while, Farragut still commanded the blockade. He was borrowing coal from the Army because the Navy didn't have any, and he fought with bureaucrats in Washington for fuel and ammunition. And so he's got a pretty full plate. Next. The battle for New Orleans. The problem that they have to do with to get back up the river because of the mud and the silt that's come into place, before I address this slide, they have to actually work it out so that the sloops and some of the ships that are going to go up there, they have to be lighter. They have to draw less water. So they have to take a certain amount of stores and heavy material off. One, the largest ship in Glasgow's whole squadron is a frigate, and it draws 23 feet of water, and it's never going to make it. So it is left behind. Everything that goes up is a sloop, the next smaller size. The big difference is a 30-some gun ship is a frigate, a 20-some gun ship is a sloop. It'll all be sloops. So the events of the week of 18 to 24 saw Farragut's fleet accomplish what conventional wisdom said was not possible. The actions of the battle took place near the defensive forts, way far below New Orleans. The actions that comprised the battle, three things, or four things here, I guess. All right, first, the bombardment of the forts by the mortar flotilla. The idea was that was going to demoralize the troops and it would actually damage the forts and cause them to have morale problems and all that sort of thing. They had to open the boom. They had to get their ships across that barrier and up above it. And then they had to get past the forts. These forts are going to be firing at them from both sides as they go up the river. And the final action, as it actually turned out, was almost the complete destruction of the Confederate naval defense forces. Okay, Now, the things that did happen there, the bombardment of the forts, did not turn out to be as effective as it should have been, as they hoped, because it was just not, that's a masonry fort. These mortars are coming in from top. They explode. They're shrapnel. They're not digging a lot of big holes. They do manage to, in some cases, break down some of the levees that kept water out of the fort, so that Fort Jackson has a problem with being flooded. Not seriously, but, you know, several feet of water is kind of sloshy when you're trying to handle cannons and ammunition and that sort of thing. And so they did accomplish that. The mortars had a great effect on the soldiers in the fort. It was very demoralizing. By the same token, it made the watching the mortar shells go in made the Union sailors think they were doing such a great job that it would be all over. And that really wasn't the case, because they weren't actually damaging the forts that much. The opening of the boom, we will see how that is handled, because that doesn't get handled until they start running past the fort. Okay. All right, next. Now we'll go and see the effects of the barrage. Now, 14 of these mortar boats moved into position around the corner from Fort Jackson on the night of April 17th. All right, now they're going looking to, during this week, sometime, they're going to try the run. Well, 6 mortar boats are anchored in the river so that they can send their fire up to Fort St. Philip on the northern side. The bombardment began on the morning of the 18th at a range of 2 miles. Fort Jackson's citadel and quarters were burned out, and the magazines were threatened for a time, but never exploded. Confederate fire drove these 6 mortar boats that are trying to put mortar shells into Fort St. Philip, drove them out of the middle of the river, and they had to move over to the side of the river where they were less obvious, but they could still move and continue to fire. Then on the 19th, Fort Jackson is receiving a shell a minute for most of the day. Farragut ordered his gunboats into the stream at intervals, not only to shoot at Fort St. Philip, but to help draw a little fire off of the other motor boats that are trying to hit Fort Jackson. So Farragut ordered his gunboats into the stream at intervals, again, to distribute the fire and lessen its being concentrated. Next. This is what it looks like at this stage. The mortar vessels, these are the ones that are actually hitting Fort Jackson. Now, notice that the woods were all cut down in this area so that the fort has a good field of fire out here. But the mortar vessels, they know what's going on, so they hide behind the trees over here. A mortar goes up and down, and so the trees don't make a big problem. The 6 that are going to be firing on Fort St. Philip will be over here. They start out in the middle. They draw too much fire, and they move them off to the side. But here, the boom is still in place. Louisiana is this point right here. That's the new 16-gun ironclad that has propulsion problems. And it will be there. It is going to be a floating battery. It is not going to actually try to get underway and fight. And then these are the number of the smaller craft, the Confederate craft that are here, just waiting for this daring Farragut to come through the boom and come around and try to go up to New Orleans. Next. And this is a mortar boat. As you can see, that goes up, way up, and then way down. All right, that could be a real fearsome sight at night, I would presume. But this is Fort Jackson, and it's based on a drawing afterwards. And I put in 2 circles here, which actually show that there are a couple of places here where the outer breach. The outer levees of the fort have been breached, and that's what's allowed. It doesn't get up to the level of the guns. It doesn't really affect anything, except it just makes life miserable inside the fort. Okay, next. One mortar boat, one of Porter's boats, is actually sunk by a direct hit from a return shell from the fort. The barrage continued otherwise unabated, and that was the only loss. Throughout the 20th, thousands of Union mortar shells are fired day and night. They often hit in the mud before exploding. That would create a bang, and it would throw a lot of mud around, but it's not terribly dangerous, all right? It's got to hit, if those shells were coming in to where they would hit the masonry fort and blow that apart, that would be a different story. But generally, when they come down from the top, there's a layer of dirt on most of the stone structure, so that tends to dampen the effect. But while the physical damage to the fort is light, the effect on the fort's garrison disheartening. Fort Jackson became a swamp inside because of the water level and the high water. Now, Fort Jackson's garrison is forced to seek shelter in the casemates just because of the shells coming in. It's danger. And their morale dropped while Farragut's sailors, overestimating the effect of the mortar shells, become more confident. Okay, next. Breaching the boom. All right, on the night of the 20th, the Union gunboats, Itasca and Pinola, these are not very big ones, they probably only have two guns apiece, made a successful effort to breach the defensive boom stretched across the river. The two gunboats removed their masts to lower their silhouette, all right, before attacking the schooners that are supporting the boom and the chain, these temporary things that are put in between. Well, one schooner was set adrift when the chain holding her in place was detached. The Itasca, one of the two Union boats, went aground, but luckily he was pulled off by the other one. The Itasca found herself upstream of the boom and putting on a full head of steam to get back on to go back home. She put on a full head of steam, rammed the chain, rode over it, and caused it to break. And that was what Farragut needed to get his ships, big ships, in the next day. The resulting gap in the boom was wide enough to accommodate Farragut's larger ships. Next. The Ram Louisiana, that's parked over there under Fort St. Philip. The Confederate Ram Louisiana is being towed into place under the guns of Fort St. Philip the same night. The Louisiana's engines are barely operable and under repair. Her gun ports are too small, which means she has a limited field of fire. And one of the strange things is that the two ironclads that are being built in New Orleans at the order of Stephen Mallory, the Secretary of the Navy of the Confederate government, is that he provides the drawings from Richmond and does not hire local people in New Orleans that probably would have done a little better job in a lot of ways of designing those particular ships. But it's a little too late to do anything about that by this time. Well, Louisiana's engines are barely operable and under repair. The Army commander wanted her moved closer to the boom to draw some fire away from him. Louisiana captain says, no, I want to stay under the guns of the fort. All right, next. This is not actually a picture of the ship. What this is on a visit to Vicksburg a few years ago, there is a gentleman who has put together a bunch of models that he claims model virtually all of the Confederate ironclads. And I think they're more in the neighborhood of tabletop models, but this gives you the idea of the prominent features. And the features that are prominent are the two paddle wheels are a center line, one right in front of the other, which as even one of the Confederate naval officers really acknowledged, he was going to have a heck of a time trying to steer that thing when both of these rotors are going at the same time. But it had twin rotors here, and it had twin rudders as well. But the ability for that ship to actually train, the gun ports were very small and didn't give it a very wide field of fire. Okay. Well, now Farragut. what's he going to do before he knows that they've got a channel through the boom now? So he's got to prepare to run the gauntlet. So he removes masts from some of the gunboats. That's, I think, purely to make them less visible, just not attract them by those masts are visible from a long way away. Most of the ships use mud for camouflage. And then they would fake down chain along their sides for temporary armor. Yeah, when you fake chain, you lay it down, pin it here, then you bring it back, pin it here. You're using it as temporary armor. You're taking chain and running it back and forth, pinning it both ends. It's temporary armor, all right? So he does that. He has sandbags placed because a lot of these ships are now steamships. You want to protect the engineering spaces. They put small howitzers in the fore and main tops, and the splinter nets are put in place. Some ships painted the decks white to improve visibility for handling guns at night. The splinter nets, that's an easy, interesting thing. In the days of wooden ships, one of the biggest hazards to health in the midst of a sea fight is splinters. Every time a big shell...
The library will close in about 30 minutes at 9 o'clock. If you need to make arrangements for a ride home, please do so now. If you need to apply for a library card, please go to the checkout desk now. Thank you.
Yeah, these splinter nets, all right, are intended to catch splinters because that's what causes a tremendous number of the casualties in a seagoing fight. And so Farragut has them rigged. Some ships painted the decks white. All the ships are trimmed down by the bow. They put more weight forward, lift their tail ends a little higher, and that means you can, if you go aground, you can back out easier with the help of the four-knot river current. You can go up forward. You can throw some things overboard, lighten the ship forward, and the current can help move you off. So Farragut has done some very, very clever things to prepare his fleet. Next. What Farragut has in mind, he divides his ships into three groups. The heavy division, based on those 20-gun sloops, those are going to be the part of the heart of the heavy divisions. And the gunboats are the small ones. There are going to be a number of them. But his original plan was he wanted to send one division on this side of the channel and the other division on this side of the channel so that each division could fire at one fort. But it turns out they only had one break in the chain, in the boom. So they had to go in single file. So the first division went in first, and they had to fire at both sides or wherever they happened to be closer to when they got in there. And then the gunboats would come in behind. Okay. This is Farragut's order of battle, his first division. Okay, the sloop, the Mississippi frigate, these are the two big ships in the first division. They carry the big guns. This is a sloop, 20 guns or so. The Mississippi, somewhat more, probably 30. And notice it's a frigate, but it's a sidewheeler. Been around for a long time. The Hartford is in the second division sloop. That is Farragut's flagship. Brooklyn and Richmond are two sloops, 20 guns, 20 guns. So he's got about 60 guns here. They've got about 50 guns here. Exclusive of these gunboats. The gunboats are only carrying a couple of guns. They're smaller, but they can make a lot of trouble. So the third division then comes up at the end of the line. The Confederate side, all right, the Louisiana, ironclad, 16 guns. Not going to get underway. He's going to stay tied up. The McRae and Jackson, a couple of small ships. The Manassas, the ironclad ram. It only has one gun, but remember it's a ram. And then they have things called Launch 3 and Launch 6, which suggests they're not terribly large. The Louisiana State Navy, Governor Moore and Governor Quitman, the River Defense Force, Warrior, Stonewall Jackson, Defiance, Resolute, General Lovell, and Breckinridge. So the difference in the number of guns is tremendous. The Union probably has 160 guns. The number of guns that are posing it on the Confederate ships, probably in the neighborhood of 50, probably a third of that. All right, next. So Farragut then, at 2 o'clock in the morning on the 24th of April, the flagship Hartford hoists the signal to get underway, two red lanterns. The Confederate defenders had taken note of their preparations and are expecting the attack. Bonfires had been prepared because they want to get the ships. They're supposed to be on the opposite side of the river, so as the Union ships go in front, they're in silhouette, and they can be shot at and identified and shot at. So that preparation has been made. The battle began in earnest as the Pensacola, the 1st Division, passed the barrier. The forts opened fire, and the mortar boat shells go arcing into the sky. The ships fire grape and canister. These are shells that are intended at anti-personnel. They're not trying to batter the forts down. They're trying to get at the gunners. The Pensacola closed Fort St. Philip and fired two broadsides. The Mississippi came next, and it was just actually the Manassas made an attempt to ram, but he hit a glancing blow, and that doesn't quite do it. That isn't enough to really put a hole in the Mississippi. Next. And this is a painting, the Farragut passing Fort Jackson. So if that's Farragut, that would be the Hartford, and it's going by here. And here are the gunners at Fort Jackson. It's not terribly wide. It's probably a very, very vivid fight on this evening at 3 and 4 in the morning. Next slide. Okay, the Mississippi was swept across the river and engaged Fort Jackson. As the 2nd Division entered the fray, the Hartford brushed a fire raft. The Confederates have prepared fire rafts. They set them on fire, and they let them drift down the river with the current, hoping they'll go alongside and set the invading ships on fire. Well, the 2nd Division entered the fray. Hartford brushed a fire raft near Fort St. Philip, and in trying to evade that fire ram, the Hartford ran aground. Now, that's Farragut's flagship, and he's on it, okay? Shells rolled down from the deck of the Hartford, sank the fire raft. And then as soon as the fire raft was out of the way, the Hartford fired a gun, her guns in the broadside, and sank the unarmed tug that was pushing the fire barge. But Hartford extinguished the fire, backed off the shoal, because remember, she'd been loaded heavy forward. She could unload and back out. Brooklyn received the most damage of the major ships. She collided with another Union ship in trying to pass the boom. And then she was rammed by the Manassas. This is the second ship rammed by Manassas. At first, nobody thought that Brooklyn had serious damage. And it wasn't until the next morning that they looked at it and found out, yeah, she had had some pretty serious damage that had to be repaired. The gunboat Iroquois badly shot up after blundering into the stationary Louisiana, and it was the last Union ship to actually clear the forts. Okay? And this is a situation, and this is Fort St. Philip. Over here is Fort Jackson. These are all the mortar boats back here. These are the ships over here that are in close shooting at Fort Jackson. Here is this rounded thing here. That's the Manassas. That's the Ram Manassas. These are a couple of the Confederate ships dueling the Union ships on this side, and here are some more small Confederate ships. But this is the Hartford as it's going on down. And here is the 16-gun ship tied up alongside the under the fort. So it's a very chaotic scene in the middle of the night, but there's probably lots of light from various things, okay? This shows the track of the Brooklyn, okay, as it goes down between the two. They actually have it gets rammed by the Manassas. Go ahead. Three gunboats did not complete the transit. Two of them, turned back after a shot through the boiler. Winona and Kennebec got fouled in the boom and gave up. The entire action between the forts and the fleet took little more than an hour. All the Union ships took hits, but none were sunk. All above the forts in the early dawn, several sharp actions took place. The Manassas, who is trying to follow the Union ships as they go upriver, stalking the Union ships, went aground to avoid a charge from the larger Mississippi. The gunboat Varuna, a Union gunboat, was attacked and forced ashore by the Governor Moore, but the Moore in turn is sunk by other Union gunboats. And in the end, all but two Confederate warships are either captured or destroyed. And the USS Mississippi has very similar track. I think we can go to the next one. This shows as the Union ships actually clear, they go on down here in the night. This is what's called the quarantine station. And this is where incoming merchant ships were normally stopped to get to clear quarantine. And so just beyond this point is where the Union ships will hope to be in the morning, and they will anchor there and take a look and see how badly they're hurt. So they will take go all the way down to here. And here's the Governor Moore ramming the Varuna up here, and the Stonewall ramming the Varuna as well. So that's all this action taking place up here. Go ahead. Well, summing up, personnel casualties are remarkably light. 39 killed, 179 wounded. Confederate, 84 killed and 110 wounded. Only CSS Manassas had made repeated attacks on the Union fleet. The Louisiana was completely ineffective. Confederate gunboats were sunk individually upstream, where their most effective use would probably have hit the Union ships as they tried to come through the boom. The novice artillerists in the forts were firing high and their fire was not nearly as effective as the Union ship fire. Go ahead. Okay, after the battle, the Union fleet anchored off quarantine for the afternoon of April 24th. They would proceed further upstream to New Orleans the next day. Regarding the forts now in his rear, Farragut sent to Porter. See, Porter stays behind with the mortar boats, and so he sends this message back. I think if you send a flag of truce and demand their surrender, they will do it, for their intercourse with the city is cut off. Porter is worried that the forts have not been damaged and they're still there. And Farragut's saying, "No, I think we've fixed them." A few salvos from the Union guns as they approach. This is now approaching New Orleans. The Chalmette Battery is all the way up on the outskirts of the city. They go in there. And with a couple of salvos, they silence the whole battery, and they anchor off New Orleans on the afternoon of the 25th. The city is ablaze with burning ships, supplies, and stores. The unfinished ironclad Mississippi was burned and abandoned to prevent it being captured. General Lovell had few troops. He had abandoned the city to save the city from a Union bombardment by the fleet. Farragut's representatives went ashore to demand the city surrender, and after the Confederate troops withdrew, they started negotiations with the mayor. The mayor insisted that as a civilian official, he was not authorized to surrender the city militarily. Well, Farragut said, "Well, all right." So Farragut said, "Fine, all right, I'll send 250 Marines with a howitzer, and we'll fly the U.S. flag from the city hall." It wasn't realized at the time, but one of Secretary Welles' requirements was he wanted the U.S. flag flown from the post office in New Orleans, okay, or City Hall. The actual occupation of the city did not take place until General Butler's Union troops arrive a few days later on the 1st of May. Due to the mounting political pressure because of the loss of New Orleans, Lovell gets relieved. In December of 62, once all this dies down. But he requests a court of inquiry to clear his name. It pretty much does clear his name, but it points a lot of fingers to the mistakes that were made, leaving the poor guy with no troops to defend the largest and richest city in the Confederacy. So, next. This is Captain George Bailey, he was the head of Division One, and he is the one who's going on his way to the city hall to accept the surrender of New Orleans. Okay. Go ahead. Meanwhile, back at the forts, Porter worried about the forts and expressed his concern to Farragut. Rumors of the surrender of the city of New Orleans and the arrival of Butler's troops to block the roads leading from the forts to the city caused the demoralized troops at the forts to mutiny. The forts surrendered on April 28th. And so there really was no problem with the forts thereafter.
Your attention, please. Okay. The library will be closing in about 10 minutes.
Louisiana was burned and the fort was surrendered. While burning, she broke loose and drifted until she exploded in front of Fort St. Philip and sank. Okay?
Please take all materials to the checkout desk. If you need help finding materials, please go to the...
Farragut had demonstrated what most commanders, so many commanders on both sides had not. What could be accomplished by prompt, vigorous action based on sound judgment? France had been eyeing the Confederacy very sympathetically as a potential friend in Latin America and the Caribbean until the fall of New Orleans. Had the Union failed, France might well have elected to recognize the Confederacy. With the fall of New Orleans, the Union had a chance to isolate Mobile before it could be strengthened. But President Lincoln said no, and the Mississippi Valley had priority, so it took 2 years before they let Farragut loose to take Mobile Bay. All right, I think that'll wrap us up for now. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have. Okay. Any questions? Sir.
Why didn't Farragut have the Powhatan at his disposal for the attack?
For that, I really don't know specifically. It had been there initially, and he did not use them all. He couldn't. His largest ship was the Colorado. It was a frigate, and it drew 23 feet, and he couldn't use that. It may have been probably for some administrative reason, because Farragut was not intimidated by the Confederate force he was going up against. So I don't think it would be considered that to be a real problem. Yes, sir.
There were some historians that would say that the fall of New Orleans was the true high water mark of secession rather than the loss of Gettysburg in 18. New Orleans, these bonds couldn't be supported, the cotton couldn't be shipped, and that from then on, it was just downhill with respect to funding of the war. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's a very, like many other things, that's something that is true. A lot of people would like to look at other things as well, but that is certainly very true. That was the richest city in the Confederacy. It was like losing the jewel in the crown at the start of the war. It just... Yeah, biggest port, most populous city, and it was. There were some. You can see that both sides. You see it at the end. Lincoln making the decision that he doesn't want to go after Mobile. Well, a little bit earlier, it had been Jefferson Davis saying, "No, New Orleans is well protected. Nobody is going to get through those swamps, and so send all your troops north." Both of those were probably. Could have shortened the war, perhaps, one way or the other. I don't know which, but okay. Well, let me
quick
get.
Question.
Yeah.
Considering the swamps, how are Porter and Farragut talking to one another after one's above the port and the other guy's below?
Well, they have. They probably have small boats that are able to go up and down. They wouldn't have instantaneous communication. No, it would take a little while. Yeah. Okay. One more.
You mentioned that Revell was the commissioner of streets in New York City.
Yep.
Well, I was under the impression that Gustav Smith, who was Johnston's second in command, also held that position.
I don't know anything about Smith. Biographies I see of General Revell, he was a West Point graduate and had been the street commissioner for the city of New York. I have often wondered how he got to be selected by that position in the Confederate government, because he normally, a lot of the generals that went south had some relations there, or they married a wife from the south, or but that didn't appear to be the case with Lavelle. Yeah, but I can't shed any light on that. All right, well, thank you very much. Yeah.